This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The richest black man in America made a pledge that could radically transform the lives of close to 400 recent college graduates.
Now, I've got the alumni over there, and this is a challenge to you, alumni. This is my class, 2019. And my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
That is billionaire investor Robert F. Smith, in his commencement address at Morehouse College earlier this month. His gift of some $40 million has renewed the public conversation about America's student debt crisis, which disproportionately affects black students. Can philanthropy really be a substitute for public policy? One of the many topics we'll tackle today on Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll review a new docuseries about the Wu-Tang Clan, a time travel flick set in modern-day Brooklyn, and preview Rihanna's Fenty fashion line. Joining us for that and much, much more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks, Frank.
And Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
Self-made billion. What good news. And they never do this at Duke. They never do this at Duke because they have parents who come in and say that, right? Their parents say that. But in this case, Robert F. Smith surprised a lot of people. Natalie, what did you think when you heard that?
I mean, I was elated. Yeah. I mean, just the display of this black man who is a billionaire. Just that first and foremost is, you know, an amazing thing. And it was so funny because I just found out about Robert F. Smith through Stanley Nelson's Boss documentary, which we talked about last month. But I'm just so excited for the students who are going to benefit from this gift, because student debt, student loan debt, when you are starting out and you are trying to figure out not only how you're going to begin your career, but just get a job, period. You know, a lot of young people, and especially young people of color, end up having to take jobs because they've got to pay those loans. And this now allows at least these 400 kids from Morehouse to be able to think about their careers and what they really want to do, as opposed to, let me do something so that I can pay off my student loans.
Mark?
If you're Robert Smith, you know, it's also a challenge to other alumni of the University of Morehouse. It's also a challenge to those 400 young men about what responsibility looks like. You know, if someone passes on to you, then you have to pass it on to somebody else. There's something ironic about the fact that, you know, Robert Smith has the plainest name you could imagine. And just even on the basis of his name, he's someone who wouldn't stand out.
Right.
Right. It's not like you could just simply Google Robert Smith and not come up with a million other Robert Smiths. But, you know, this is also something that's been part of his legacy, right? He gives the Smithsonian $20 million to finish the National Museum of African American Culture. He's had a long history of philanthropy that's been kind of on the underground, so folks didn't know it. There are obviously questions and critiques that were raised. What does it mean to give this essentially to an all-male school? You know, as opposed to an HBCU where you had both women and men. Of course, then it becomes now a challenge to someone like Oprah or a range of other folks,
right?
To be able to do the same thing across the yard, you know, over at Spelman. But the bigger part is that however important this gesture is and however much we should celebrate it, it doesn't alleviate what is a fundamental crisis for this generation of college students and the folks coming behind them around student loan debt. You know, many of us, 20, 30 years ago, were able to go to public schools and not have to amass this amount of debt. If I had to face the amount of debt that students are facing now to go to a place like a Duke or Brown or even a UNC Chapel Hill, I probably would not have chosen to go to school, right? Because and my parents couldn't afford it even 30 years ago. There's no way in hell they would be able to afford it now.
I just want to lift up, I mean, in light of what Mark just said, I think, you know, in this particular moment when, you know, we live in a very polarized society, to say the least, and a lot of the issues that we have in this country are being laid bare in particular because of who is in the White House. It, you know, watching this gift be made by Robert Smith brought to mind a slogan that my friend and world scholar Yaba Blay often says, which is, "We all we got." And to me, Robert Smith doing this, even though it's true, it doesn't alleviate the larger problem. But if he's not going to do it, if Beyonce's not going to do it, if Jay-Z's not going to do it, if the black people who have the resources to make a gift like this are not going to do it, ain't nobody else going to do it.
Well, but that raises the question, why ain't nobody else going to do it? And shouldn't that be where the focus is? And doesn't a thing like this, and nobody's going to criticize a $40 million gift to those students who now can go forward for all the reasons. Nobody's going to criticize that. But it does also raise this question of exceptionalism, if he can do it, well, you know, the sort of rags to riches, which then relieves us of asking the bigger question, why right. doesn't the United States right. of America invest in right. all of its right. children because all right. of its children are all of its future?
Right.
Because individual philanthropy is not going to alleviate the structural realities of what poverty looks like, of which glass ceilings look like in terms of the inability to have access to quality higher education. Individual philanthropy is not going to address that to the extent that it needs to be addressed.
Right. Right?
And that means, how do we celebrate philanthropy in this case, but also continue to put pressure on the state, if you will, to be able to do right, you know, in terms of being able to educate its citizens?
One of the ways you do that is by bringing other people into the field when it comes to electoral politics. And that is something that happened in 2018 in an election that saw a lot of people running for office and many winning who we had not seen before. So I want to turn now to the political documentary Knock Down the House, which profiles four progressive women who challenged incumbent Democrats in 2018. Let's listen to a clip from the film.
You know, I grew up in poverty. I was raised by a single mother. And so I learned how to fight early on. Now that my eyes are open, I cannot and I will not close them again.
The person I'm running against is complacent, but I'm not. I myself can de-escalate a person with a gun. And I'm not a police officer, so I wonder how come they can't do it.
I'm running because of Cori Bush. I'm running because of Paula Jean Swearingen. I'm running because everyday Americans deserve to be represented by everyday Americans.
And it's time for ordinary people to do extraordinary things. Let's raise some hell and take our lives back.
Amy Villela, Cori Bush, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Paula Jean Swearingen, four progressive candidates featured in the new documentary Knock Down the House. Talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel today. Natalie, these four women represent a wide range of candidates, really, who ran for election. And the film showcases their struggle and also kind of this backdrop against which they ran, right? This political architecture that we have,
right.
That they're running against in a way.
Right, right. I mean, it was fascinating to me to, first of all, see some of the, like, behind the scenes machinations of, you know, how candidates are selected, how they're sort of, you know, kind of the king making, as it were, that happens. And then to see these candidates really grapple with what it means to go up against basically the system and you know, these incumbents in some cases who have, you know, are entrenched in politics and in D.C. and in Congress and have been for years. And to see someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, to watch that process, you know, that we hear about, right? We hear about how she came from these humble beginnings, but to see, you know, a little bit of her struggle, to actually see her apartment, to see her walk the streets and meet people and see how they engage with her. And also to see that she's been pretty much who we see on television all along was really good to see. It was good to see that grit and fearlessness that are basically hallmarks of who she seems to be are authentic. And, you know, that it was really impactful for someone like her to win. And she takes it seriously. You know, that scene at the end where she's, and spoiler alert, but, you know, where she's in front of the Capitol,
yeah.
you know, and just reflecting and crying and thinking about her father and, you know, hoping that she's made him proud really touched me, because to me that is the essence of the American dream. And so it was just like a little glimpse of what seems to very quickly be fading right before our eyes.
Or not, depending on the results. Depending. But she was the only one of the four who actually won. Mark, what was your take?
What's important about films like this is that it demystifies the process, particularly for young women thinking about getting into electoral politics and organizing. Mm-hmm. You know, in this way, the documentary is groundbreaking, right? You know, we didn't get to see documentaries of Bella Abzug, you know, for example, 40 years ago, that would have inspired younger women to think about running for office. And because of the social media moment and all these increased media platforms, you know, young women, young girls get a chance to see this up front. And I think it's important when you think about this moment now with Nancy Pelosi and the doctored video of her that circulated on Facebook and Twitter. And she's been having conversation with women who are like, you've inspired me to do this, but then I'm concerned when I see what happens to the lives of women. Knock down the house is a reminder, right, that, no, this stuff is really important. It's important for you to step up and take the mantle and deal with the good and the bad in the context of this.
And apparently not just a film that's good for us. Netflix spent $40 million to distribute this film, so it's going to be a film that apparently they think somebody actually wants to watch.
Right.
Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, teaching assistant professor, $10 million. I'm sorry, it was a $10 million. It's still a lot of money. Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal are here with me on Back Channel today. Just ahead, we preview a new four-part Showtime docuseries of Mics and Men that traces the legacy of the Wu-Tang Clan. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal are with me today on Back Channel. Natalie is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark is James B. Duke Professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. And before the break, we started talking about the new Netflix documentary, Knock Down the House. And to be clear, Netflix has paid $10 million for that series. And it followed four progressive women running for office in 2018, including New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Let's listen to a clip from the film's director, Rachel Lears.
We were very prepared for all four of these candidates to lose. That was part of the reason that we chose people who had very strong personalities and a charismatic on-screen presence and their very personal stories. But we were also very interested in looking at races that would allow us to explore the nature of power in this country, really looking at what political machines look like in different parts of the country. We're thrilled, of course, that it includes this historic victory, but I think that, you know, we made sure to include the races in which the candidates don't win as part of that conversation.
Rachel Lears, director of the Netflix documentary Knock Down the House, talking on PBS television program Amanpour and Company. I'm here with Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. What do you take from that? I mean, Mark, on the one hand, it shows you talked just before the break. You said, look, now we can see there's a pathway forward. Three of the four lost to the race. I mean, what do we take away from the film?
Well, I think it's important not to put a nicely tied bow on top of what American politics are right now. You're going to lose some of these races. But of course, we know in terms of House races, you know, if you're competitive in a race and you lose, there's a very good chance you'll be not only competitive 2 years down the road, but will have the capacity to win, you know, once you have name recognition. Of course, the film in some ways was important for those women who didn't win, because it does give them a kind of visibility and name recognition that they didn't have beforehand that they can parlay into something. I mean, we see this with Stacey Adams and Stacey Abrams, excuse me, thinking about my shoes. you know, we see that in Stacey Abrams in Georgia, how she lost. But in some way, in losing, she has a much higher profile and impact on the culture than she had before then.
And remember, these are primary fights, right? This is within the Democratic Party, all four of these in this case. So this is party leaders are also taking note and watching the traction that these women had. Right. Yeah, they didn't win, but they had a fair amount of traction. And look at the attention they're getting. So it cannot be lost on them either.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of, I wonder how how dirty and down in the gutter the politics can get. You know, I think about the scenes where AOC, you know, as she is called, you know, was going directly up against, you know, the incumbent, right. Especially there was like a town hall meeting where, you know, she calls him out, right. Like in front of, you know, the whole crowd, and everybody like appreciates and applauds that. It doesn't always work that way, you know? And so I think part of what Knock Down the House does is it demonstrates the type of, I think, personality, stick-to-itiveness that is required to get through that type of campaign. And so I think in some ways, you know, it's a primer to let some of us know, okay, that's not for me, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it does, I think, you know, demonstrate that it's possible. You can actually break through that ceiling.
Joe Crowley, the incumbent, had been there for a long time. And, you know, when he was knocked out, again, as Mark was saying earlier, it shows it can be done. And so it's got all that stuff going for it and not a Hollywood ending.
You know?
So all of that. Well, let's talk about Hollywood for just a moment. At least Hollywood feature style films. The Netflix film See You Yesterday, that is a twist on a time travel movie trope, tells the story of two precocious teenagers in Brooklyn who invent a backpack that can take them back in time. Eventually, they decide to use those powers to undo the harms of a wrongful police shooting. Natalie, set up the premise. Tell us more about this film.
So this is about two teenagers, CJ and her friend Sebastian, who are just geeked out about science and time travel and are excellent students already. We have entered into territory that is not usually touched upon by Hollywood or anybody else. So they go on to successfully travel back in time one day, because that's as far as their technology will take them. And some things go awry. And each time they try to correct what has gone wrong that last trip, something else goes wrong and it gets very complicated and twisted. And I think it's brilliant. The storytelling, the writing is, I think, exemplary. And it's so interesting to me that it is a Spike Lee produced film. But Spike didn't direct it. He didn't write it. And I think that for me, that's a good thing. I really appreciate, though, that he is the one who pushes this forth.
I mean, to start with the Spike Lee part of it, I mean, we just talked about Robert Smith and philanthropy. For Spike Lee, who's also a graduate of Morehouse, his back supporting Stephon Bristol, who is a Morehouse graduate in this project, is another form of philanthropy.
Yes, it is.
That doesn't, you know, necessarily resonate in the kind of ways that we think about it. The story was amazing to me, and it resonated on so many different levels. You know, first of all, it's like Back to the Future, you know, meets The Hate U Give. And the fact that they were able to get Michael J. Fox to do a cameo as the science teacher was like, you know, for those of my generation, that's like,
it was
everything.
Yeah.
But it was personal in a couple of ways. I mean, part of their story is the kind of commute that's associated with travels to the elite schools and how minority families are always so willing. So they're traveling from East Flatbush every day to Bronx Science, right? It's the reverse of what my commute was, which was from the Bronx to Brooklyn Tech. But you see the way that these communities, these ethnic communities, these racial communities are so committed to education and opportunity for the children, they're willing to put them on a train or a bus for 2 hours a day to have that kind of experience. The other thing that I loved about the film, and Maya Phillips wrote a piece in the New Yorker that kind of captures this, right? You know, if you're talking about time traveling, there are perils to time traveling while black, you know, which is exactly her line. And you see that you just cannot do this nicely and neatly because the violence in black communities are so random, right, that you couldn't even imagine what was going to happen Sebastian when they go back that first time. The other thing that I loved about it was the way that it captured black ethnic communities. The scene at the cookout where they're playing dominoes, and just everything from the way that the dominoes get smacked down.
Right.
Whenever they time travel and they come back to that little space, that little alley, and the Jamaican dude who responds in all kinds of different patois. I think we got a bumper clod out of him at some point, you know in the film. And so I just love that. But also the ending where she goes back again, right?
Yep.
this reference to Harriet Tubman, and I would even say a reference to Halle Jarima Sankofa at the end, where we just see the character running off, knowing, you know, what is going to happen is probably going to end in her death. CJ is willing to go back again and again.
Yeah.
Well, you talked about too, Mark, the fact that this commute is essential to the plot line, right? Yeah. And it's preserved because these are two precocious kids. These are black kids going to the science school, right? But the neighborhood isn't lost in all of this, and I think it shows up. We've got a clip here, I think, that gives us an illustration that the neighborhood that CJ comes from, when she's talking to her brother, it's very clear that this is not just about two precocious kids, you know, in a rarefied environment. They come from someplace.
Yeah. All right, damn, I know you mad about early, all right? But I was just looking out for you, all right? I'm not trying to, like, say you can't handle yourself or come off all misogyny and shit either.
Misogyny is a noun defined as the hatred of or contempt for or prejudice against women, while misogynistic is the correct adjective you're looking for to describe you as someone who professes misogyny.
I'm mad you really explained that, though. Like, you just went mad hard for no reason.
See, that's a clip from See You Yesterday, Netflix film, director Stefan Bristol, producer Spike Lee, Natalie Bullock Brown, and Mark Anthony Neal.
I mean, there's so many things that I'm thinking about just from that scene. I one of the things that I think Spike and John Singleton was good for this too, but Spike has been just amazing for over the years as he introduces this new talent that goes on to do amazing things. And I know we're going to hear from the character or the young woman who plays CJ. We're going to hear from her again. We're going to see her again. We're going to see her brother again. But I also, there was something that Mark said about this commute, and the community is intact. It is, in fact, in many ways a character in the film. But one of the things that I really loved also was the way that this immigrant family that Sebastian comes from, you know, is represented. And it's what I know of New York. It's these hardworking immigrant families who want the best for their kids and will ship them several boroughs away to get the best education and invest everything in the future, which they see in their kids. And that's really well represented. And Sebastian is, you know, there's so much wrapped in his character in the way that he is, you know, in cahoots with CJ. You know, he is the mastermind behind a part of the technology that they develop. But then also what happens to him and the way that devastates, I mean, literally devastates his family, and CJ's sense of responsibility to go back and fix that, right? I mean, all of it, it's just so well woven together. It's so intricately woven together, and it's doing so much work on so many different levels.
Well, when you talk about the power of bringing forward two new young directors, somebody like Stefan Bristol, who comes onto the scene, and that gets to something I think we've talked about many times on this segment, which is diversity. Adding more voices brings a greater diversity. And you talked about the neighborhood and the patois and some of the things that you see that you don't often see. And in fact, Stefan Bristol, the director, talked about that.
My parents are from Guyana, and they struggled a lot to just even get a house in Brooklyn. I grew up in Coney Island, so we had a townhouse. And I always go to East Flatbush to get clothes from Vims and Jimmy Jazz and Bobby's. And I be of West Indian descent, I'd never seen that before. We always have a movie about Black American experience, but never about the Black immigrant experience.
That's Stefan Bristol, the director of the new time travel movie, See You Yesterday, streaming on Netflix. And I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal for this episode of Back Channel. Let's turn now to a new four-part Showtime docuseries of Mics and Men from director Sasha Jenkins. It tells the story of the hip-hop group Wu-Tang Clan, and we can hear a clip from that episode right here.
Some of the best MCs that I've heard are the homies I hang with, my peers. They was different, yo.
Overachiever, power hungry overeater. I 9-to-5, whip fly like an overseer. I'm overconfident, but some might say I'm overeager or overzealous, especially when it's overachiever.
It was something that only Staten Island had developed. I named it the Wu-Tang slang. Wu-Tang became the style that identified the best MCs.
That's RZA, the de facto leader of the Wu-Tang Clan, talking in the first episode of a four-part Showtime docuseries of Mics and Men. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Mark, set us up. Tell us about Wu-Tang.
So Wu-Tang is a group, you know, first of all, we think about hip-hop in New York. You know, we think Brooklyn, and we obviously think Bronx is the home of hip-hop because of folks like Nas. We think about Queens. Well, nobody thinking about Staten Island. Even in the five boroughs, ain't nobody thinking about Staten. I mean, you got to hop on a ferry. And I mean, it's just all, got to take this large bridge, it burns out. And so the idea that there would be these four rappers, you know, what am I saying?
Four, right?
As Nas says in the documentary, it's like, it was like 100 of them would be coming up on stage. But the fact is you're dealing with these cats who are coming out of Staten Island, who are landlocked in many ways, who have these fantasies of a world that's a whole world away from them, and watching these, you know, these kung fu flicks, who are imagining a world from them in this landlocked space, and creating this unique sound and style that dramatically alters what we thought about as hip-hop in the mid-1990s, right? And this is, of course, in the midst of the whole G-Funk moment, where hip-hop is being taken over by Dr. Dre and the sonic sound that was coming from the L.A. that was very polished and glossy, and Wu-Tang is coming with something that's so gritty and dirty and grimy, right? No one said grimy in hip-hop until they heard a Wu-Tang song.
But also, well, Natalie, what was your take on this and the idea that the importance of this group and our understanding its history?
Well, this is like my introduction to Wu-Tang, honestly. When I lived in New York, I followed Method Man. I heard of and knew about ODB, Raekwon, but I had never really gotten into Wu-Tang Clan. I did not know there were that many of them. I didn't know their names. I could have walked past them on the street and wouldn't have known who I was passing. So it was really a treat, actually. It was a delight to have the opportunity to meet these guys on their terms, learn their stories, hear about the hardships and just all of the challenges that they dealt with when they were young, and then to see how they turn that. I mean, it's quintessential hip-hop. This is what's at the heart of hip-hop, is you turning that hardship, that trauma, that oppression into something that is golden. And they did that. I mean, RZA's brain and his brilliance and his ability to have a vision to basically see how all of them could get out of that landlock that Mark talks about, I think is just an incredible story. And it really gives me a lot of inspiration and hope, but at the same time it underscores the fact that no one in America should have to live the way that they did.
Well, I think what is important, especially for people on the outside looking in, to understand that that history, that grit, that grime wasn't all crime. It was a lot of hard work. It was cleaning toilets at the Statue of Liberty, and here's Ghostface Killah in the documentary talking about his childhood.
I was the only one from Stapleton. Our project was known for our knuckle game. Raekwon and them, they lived in Park Hill. We had to meet in the middle to go to the same junior high school. You know, and that's how we really got to know each other. Life, you know what I mean? It's father split with your mother, like the regular shit. It's like, okay, mommy taking care of you. You know what I mean? After a while, mommy had two kids with muscular dystrophy. You know what I mean? So that's hard on mommy. Mommy start drinking. I'm the oldest, so I gotta take care of the two brothers. You see what I'm saying? Pick them up off the toilet, put them on the toilet, put them in the bed, dress them. Me. My little body. You know, maybe I was depressed and don't even know that you're depressed. What kids would go through. It wasn't no $300 Jordans. It was those kind of times.
Ghostface Killah, a member of Wu-Tang Clan, talking in the first episode of the four-part Showtime docuseries of Mics and Men. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. And Mark, it also talks about, and I think the film speaks to, the creation of identity. You know, Natalie was talking about RZA's genius and seeing this as actually something, as a creative act, and it creates a kind of an identity.
It's his thought process for this, the fact that he invested in the group selling the Head Aloud records, you know, you're going to sign the group, but we want to have the wherewithal to sign each individual act to their own label deals, right? And you're just going to have to deal with that if you're going to run with us. And him already thinking about where he wanted people to go, right? So Method Man goes to Def Jam, right? And Method Man, pound for pound, is the star of that group, right? He was a matinee album idol. He was the one who had the kind of charisma about him. He's the one that by far has been most successful outside of hip hop, right? Mm-hmm. As an actor and other things, mm-hmm. right?
And he's fine.
Well, I kind of said that, but yes. Now, right. But then you had someone like Old Dirty Bastard, right? Who we think of as kind of a clown, but it was much more brilliant than
Absolutely.
That. And then Ghostface is like the dude who lives next door to you. Right, when you listen to his music, right, a.k.a. Tony Stark, and then you get somebody like Raekwon and like real hip-hop heads, when they talk about the folks in Wu-Tang
right.
that they love,
they talk about Raekwon,
yeah. right? And the fact that you had a group that had all of this in the mix, and he knew, you know, Raekwon, you're going to stay with Loud, right? ODB, you're going to go to Elektra, right? You know, Ghostface Killah, you're going to go to Sony. Ghostface Killah recorded for Def Jam with Jay-Z. In 5-10 years ago, right? So, you know, it's brilliant that he understood a business plan for them when they had no right going into the industry thinking that they should be able to dictate their careers the way that they did.
Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown with the latest episode of Back Channel. We'll talk about this and much, much more when our program continues. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown today on Back Channel. And just before the break, we're talking about Wu-Tang Clan and Of Mics and Men, the four-part series on Showtime that traces their development, their birth and development. We talked about the genius of RZA in this individual talent and what these guys brought to the project and what they brought to America as artists. Sasha Jenkins, the director, also talked about this, and again, something that from the outside might not be so noticeable, but in the development of hip-hop, the importance of a group, especially like Wu-Tang Clan, to kind of collect, to be the collective consciousness of a neighborhood.
We have that hustle. Capadon is telling you that same energy translated into their work ethic, but the idea that's put out there is that we don't have that. The idea is that we're lazy. The idea is that we want to sell drugs. These guys didn't want to sell drugs. The guys that I grew up with didn't want to sell drugs, but there was no social capital. But what Wu-Tang represents and what hip-hop represents is cultural capital. These guys, largely from the projects in Staten Island, have created something that doesn't just represent music. Wu-Tang represents identity. And that's what hip-hop is. You know, and bringing it back to slavery, the idea of my last name is Jenkins, that does not come from Africa. But if you're a graffiti artist or an MC, you rename yourself something. And the power of having control over your identity is the power of what hip-hop really represents. And they are the epitome of the full realization of hip-hop.
There it is. Hip-hop journalist, director, and producer Sasha Jenkins talking about his latest directorial work of Mics and Men, four-part docuseries on Showtime about Wu-Tang Clan. I mean, it's interesting. It comes full circle, at least the program. We talk about Robert Smith and financial capital and what that can bring to communities, but it starts with a communal identity and social capital.
Yeah, and let me say just a quick word about Sasha Jenkins, who founded a magazine years ago called Ego Trip and has a great ego-tripped, list of hip-hop. His partner is Raquel Cepeda. So the two of them together have been folks who have been documenting hip-hop for a long time. And I think it was important to have someone like him do the project because not everybody can go in and handle the complexity
dynamics.
And the dynamics of a group like that the way that he did. And I'm happy that he's getting the opportunity to tell these kinds of stories.
Yeah. Right? I wanted to jump on something that Sasha talks about at the head of the clip that we played, which is, you know, this work ethic that Wu-Tang, that the Clan had, and how in spite of that, what is projected in our culture is that Black people, Black men in particular, are lazy, that they don't have a work ethic, that, you know, they want to sell drugs. And that's what I was trying to get at a little earlier, is this idea that, you know, part of what this documentary demonstrates are all these ills that exist in the Black community. You know, and here's this group of guys that are legitimately trying to negotiate the hardships that their families are dealing with. I mean, when Ghostface Killah talks about his brothers, his twin brothers who have muscular dystrophy, and he's got to take care of them, right? He's trying to help his mother, you know, and that he could have been depressed and might not have even known it. You know, that's real stuff. That's real talk. And that's not just Ghostface. That's not just Wu-Tang. That's Black folks all over the country. So this idea, you know, the fact, I just love the fact that here we have a group and we have the opportunity to learn about how they take that hardship. And in spite of it, there is a resiliency. There is a brilliance that exists in Black folks that is hidden a lot of times in these communities because of the hardships and the way that those hardships really kind of chisel away at the resolve and the desire even to move forward. It's often difficult to even know how to do that.
Well, because even Power and Divine, right, the two dudes who are actually bringing the money to the table, and, you know, they don't want to tell us how they get their money. right. We can speculate how Power and Divine are providing money to this enterprise, but even the two of them are like, this was an opportunity for us to get into something different.
That's right. They wanted to get out.
They wanted
And when you talk about the grit, the determination, the resilience, the willingness and the need to do things, whatever it took to keep your family going, it's all the more painful when you think that one of those methods of keeping your family alive is criminalized, because selling onesies, selling single cigarettes is precisely that on Staten Island. That's exactly
what
it.
And so that kills Eric Garner. Right?
And kills Eric Garner. So that's the kind of thing that puts all this into a whole new perspective.
Yep.
All right, let's move on. Let's move back to the future once again, or future to the, I don't know. Let's get nostalgic with the All in the Family and the Jeffersons, an event hosted by Jimmy Kimmel and Norman Lear, starring Woody Harrelson and Marissa Tomei. Wanda Sykes is there, Jamie Foxx, and more. Mark, what do you think about the premise of this?
You know, I think I understood the spirit of it. You have a generation of folks who didn't really grow up with All in the Family. They might know the Jeffersons because, you know, it's on BET or, you know, TV One all the time. All in the Family is not as accessible to them. So why not have folks that are recognizable to them as Hollywood stars to redo it? One of my concerns about it, I thought the pacing was slow, and that might have been, you know, because it was live television. But I think the power of All in the Family in particular was the way that it spoke to the political realities of that moment. To reproduce that for this generation and then not try to reproduce it along the lines of what's happening politically now, I think is just a major fail. Yeah. There were so many references, again, particularly in the All in the Family version of it, where the references were so specific to like 1971.
Right.
We know that it went over the head of most folks under the age of 40. Why not update those references in a way that speaks to what these realities look like in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't say it better. I totally agree. I used to watch All in the Family and the Jeffersons religiously because that was pretty much all that was on television. And, you know, and there was a lot that went over my head at that time. But I can't agree more that there was an opportunity that was missed to really bring home this particular political moment through All in the Family, mainly, that just was lost.
Yeah, if you can imagine Queens today, a gentrified Queens, Meathead grows up and is a landlord. But they didn't. Here's, a quintessential example of what you're talking about, Mark, from All in the Family.
This color guy I'm telling you about, would you believe it? He makes as much money as me. Well, then he's got to be twice as smart as you. How do you get to that?
Well, that's how it works out, Bunker. I mean, when you have a black and a white guy doing the same job, like running for mayor, you know, if the black guy wants to get elected, he knows he has to be twice as smart as the white guy. I don't think so at all if you're talking about that election out there in California. No one's going to tell me that that guy Bradley's twice as smart as the other guy, Yorkie.
Okay, that would be Tom Bradley and Sam Yorty.
Right. And even if you know Tom Bradley, you have no idea who Sam Yorty
is. You don't know who Sam Yorty is. You did then. You did then. He was all over the news. He was running for everything, and including a run for president. But, of course, that's exactly it. And there's – I didn't cut it short. That was the silence that followed the line.
Right.
So I guess that was it, a missed opportunity. And it would have been interesting to see what they did. On the other hand, they were taking on some issues that may be relevant today, at least when we move to the Jeffersons, as we move on up a little bit. Let's take a look, listen to this clip from the Jefferson section of that special.
George, Diane is my friend.
No, she's not. She's a domestic.
You make it sound like a disease.
Louise, it's just part of life. I mean, you own an apartment in the building, and she's a maid.
Now, hold it right there, Buster. Ain't you forgetting where you came from?
It's not a question of where I came from. It's a question of where I am. I mean, look, Louise, you from the east side, she from the west side, and I don't want no crosstown traffic in my kitchen.
George, the Lord created everybody equal, except in your case, he quit work before he got to your head.
Look, Louise,
now, just
I ain't
because,
got...
No, just because we're moving up, there's no reason why we have to look down on people.
I'm not telling you to look down on nobody, Louise. I'm just telling you to shift your angle. And have them looking up to you for a change.
Jamie Foxx and Wanda Sykes playing the characters of George and Louise Jefferson on the reboot of The Jeffersons that aired on ABC last week. So, you know, there was some nod to that. But again, I was mostly a reboot. It was nostalgia.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking that we have come so far from live television, right? Yeah, you know, I mean, we just talked about Showtime's Wu-Tang Doc. We talked about Netflix. You know, I mean, most of what we tend to discuss, and I'm, you know, what I tend to watch is on Netflix and Hulu. Yeah. And I don't set my watch to watch anything on network television. And certainly, if I do, there is no laughter. I mean, there is no live audience.
Right, like there's no studio audience anymore.
Right, there's no studio audience. So I think that was also a part of the disconnect is that we are so far removed from that, and it feels weird, you know, unfortunately or fortunately. Yeah. It just did not work. And the pacing, I think Mark brought up earlier, it suffered a lot from the fact that it was live television, and we are just in another moment. Yeah. We're just in a different type of age.
Let's talk about Rihanna now, who just launched a new luxury clothing line under the LVMH umbrella, making her, she's now the first black woman at the helm of a first woman at all?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't even realize that, because I would have thought by now, but no. But no.
Within that
now we're talking about the Paris luxury fashion house. Yeah. So this particular house, which is a big deal. So tell us more about this line of fashion and how significant this is.
Well, I think it's incredible that Rihanna is the one who is in this position. I mean, in some ways, you know, I was thinking today, it's interesting that it's not Beyonce, that it's not someone of her stature that has been tapped for this opportunity. But I think Rihanna represents a different type of aesthetic and sort of cultural presence that apparently, you know, this house was looking for. But also everything that Rihanna has done, I mean, especially with Fenty Beauty and her cosmetics line and then her lingerie line, like she's been slowly but surely, you know, adding to her portfolio in ways that I think is very powerful. And especially because, I mean, I'm probably alone in this, but I'm not really checking her for her music. Like, I really am not. I think she's talented. I love, though, that she has used her platform to do some things, or it's allowed her to. I'm not sure that she even actually read an interview that said she wasn't, you know, she never dreamed of doing the sort of things that she's doing now. She just wanted to make music. And now she's like, I don't even know if I'm going to, you know, how much music I'm going to do, because she is passionate about what these new opportunities are affording her.
And just to be clear, she's the first woman at that house.
At that house.
But first black woman at any luxury fashion house. So to clarify all that.
Yeah. One of the things that's striking is that, you know, Rihanna is only 31 years old.
Yep.
She got started in the industry when she literally was a teenager. Her growth in that period of time is astounding, right? And first of all, let me make a quick vote for Vic Riri as opposed to any other Riri. Yeah. But the other thing that's important is that she's someone who also is studying the culture, right?
Yeah.
And so when she was asked about the inspiration for the new clothing line, right, she cites Kamau Braithwaite, you know, who's this black photographer from the 1960s, and very specifically, you know, he had a series of photos called Black is Beautiful, mm-hmm. and she went to those photos and was like, let me try to recreate that feel and that look. And that is so important, right, mm-hmm. because she's realizing there's a broader legacy, right? She's not creating necessarily anything. She's stepping into a tradition, and she's trying to uplift that tradition as she's trying to move forward.
Right.
And I'm with Natalie. You know, I love Rihanna's music, but, you know, she's transcended that now.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there are folks sitting around wondering, when's Rihanna's next record? And most folks are like, no, what's the Fenty line going to look like next
That's
year?
That's right.
And I think there's a way in which, you know, she's not in competition with Beyonce, but she would not have been able to do what she's done without the example of Beyonce.
That's
right?
true.
And
yeah.
there's going to be so many more Rihannas post Beyonce, right, that I think is even going to be much more important than who Beyonce is at this point.
Absolutely, well, let's talk about somebody who has been in the business for far longer and is also an inspiration in moving things along, Queen Latifah, creating opportunities for black women filmmakers. Talk about this and the importance of it.
So Queen Latifah has, and her Flavor Unit entertainment company has teamed up with Procter & Gamble and Tribeca Studios to create what she's calling the Queen Collective. And it's basically a funding mechanism to allow women of color filmmakers who are working in the short doc genre to make films and then have a way for them to be seen, which is how I discovered it, which is on Hulu. And it's an amazing thing because, I mean, first of all, I know people who've benefited from this. So that's exciting and inspiring to me, you know, first and foremost. But what I think is really important about this series is that this series centers stories about women of color that, just like See You Yesterday, you know, these are stories that we would not otherwise get to hear. One story in particular is called Ballet After Dark, and it is about a ballet, basically dance therapy, that this young black woman in Baltimore, who is a survivor of sexual assault, created to allow other survivors to basically work through their trauma and really empower themselves through dance. And it's just an incredible story, what she went through, how these women rally around each other. I mean, that's not the type of sexy thing that we're normally going to hear about. You know, and there's another piece that is about two young girls and their mother in a homeless shelter and how they struggle to get out of that situation. These are stories that we need. I mean, this is happening to black women and girls every day, but no one has really, I don't think there's anyone that rides for those types of stories and these everyday women. And so I just take my hat off to Queen Latifah for doing something like this.
Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke, distinguished professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.